Irreverent, entertaining, cool. You're listening to LA Talk Radio.
You're listening to the Dr. Nina Show with Dr. Nina Savelle Rocklin, only on LA Talk Radio.
Hey there, welcome to the Dr. Nina Show. I'm Dr. Nina Savelle Rocklin, and I'm a psychoanalyst specializing in weight, food, and body image issues. I'm here to help you lose weight without dieting. That means no more counting calories or carbs, no more thinking about food all the time. It really is possible to lose weight and gain health all without ever going on another diet. And if you'd like to call in and talk with me about something that's on your mind related to food, weight, or body image, the number is 818-602-4929. Again, that's 818-602-4929. You can also tweet me at WinTheDietWar. So this morning, I read a really interesting article that just came out today, and it's called, If We Don't Focus on Why People Overeat, We Will Never Solve Obesity. And you can imagine why this got my attention this morning. The writer is, I want to give her credit, Maya. Oh, her name is S-Z-A-L-A-V-I-T-Z, Zalovich. I'm going to call her Maya. Maya wrote this really interesting article, and rather than sum it up, I'm actually going to read you guys some of it, because I think it really bears as many people hearing it as possible. So this article was written in response to the idea of a sugar tax, that sugar taxes are going to solve obesity, and that in some way sugar is an addictive substance that has to be controlled or taxed or whatever. And the basis of the article is, she says that emotional, physical, or sexual abuse can lie at the root of weight problems later in life. And unless we deal with that, taxes on food types will not help at all, because actually people are self-medicating. But anyway, I'm getting ahead of myself. So she talks about this woman, Trinity Wallace Ellis, who first recalled associating food with consolation when she was about 8, and she was going through really horrific times. Her father was addicted to heroin, would be violent, would beat her and her 7 younger sisters. He would be regretful, but then, you know, the only safe place for Trinity was food. And what her father would do, or parents would do, is they would get a bunch of cakes and pies, and they would basically, the apology was the cakes and the pies. And she said, from that point on, I equated food with comfort and food as a way of making things right. So, now she's 39 years old. She's a successful foster care consultant, but she has struggled with her weight her whole life. And basically, the author makes the point that if policymakers want to fight obesity successfully, they're going to have to reckon with stories like Trinity's. So although some of her experiences are extreme, it's really important to recognize that the underlying psychology and physiology is not. So let me get ahead and say that the bottom line, says the writer, without addressing why people overeat, obesity can't be fought effectively. And although it's not clear exactly what proportion of obesity is linked to trauma or to just the stresses of poverty or difficulties in life, that there are strong correlations. So Trinity, her trauma was really more things happened, terrible things. I won't even go into it, because it'll just ruin your day to hear it. It's very depressing. But basically, she ended up in foster care, and she said, I learned early on that I was safer as the fat sister than one of the skinny ones. They didn't want the fat sister. It didn't protect me in all instances, but I think it protected me in a lot of instances. And of course, this goes to, I've talked about why people sabotage. One of the reasons they sabotage their weight loss efforts is this fear that somehow being thinner will make you an object of, a target of abuse or a target of being objectified or something terrible will happen. And so, basically, Trinity only was able to change her diet once she learned to stop blaming herself for some of the things that happened as a result of her traumatic experience. So there is a study, and then I won't go too deep in the weeds in this, but there's a study of adverse childhood experiences, and they showed a link between childhood trauma and obesity, that somehow the trauma can actually cause some changes in the brain, which was very interesting. So many of the study participants said that overeating had benefits. It meant comfort. It meant protection from abuse. It meant, you know, escape. So seeing binges as irrational and merely driven by quote-unquote addiction just made them feel really bad about themselves. They felt like, well, what's wrong with me that I can't, you know, just get over this, just change my mind, just, you know, break my habit. And they had to realize that there was something very powerful about food that they had learned early on was the only safe place for nurturing and self-soothing, really. So, and the writer goes on to say, this is why our current narrative about sugar is too simple, whether it comes from Michelle Obama or from someone like Michael Bloomberg, who wants to put a ban on sugary drinks, that there are, it ultimately won't solve the problem. So what this woman said, which I think a lot of you can probably relate to, she said, quote, you binge in secret, because then it's almost like the same cycle that any other addict goes through. She had defined herself as an addict. You say you're going to do better. You're not going to do it. You say you're not going to do it. I'm not going to eat that. And then you get triggered, and something happens, and then you want to go and eat, and then you feel shame and disappointment for not following through on what you said you were going to do. And then you think you're disappointing someone, so you do it in private. So, you know, the bottom line is people seeking relief through food will not stop needing relief if you make sugar hard to get. And that is because, you know, it is not really about, sugar is not the problem. Sugar is not the problem. Sugar is a temporary solution to the problem. Trinity says, there's nothing else that could soothe me. I didn't know how to self-soothe. And this day, these days, she says she has a list of alternative behaviors like walking that help her manage stress. But most of all, she works to have self-compassion, which is essential to keeping shame and binging at bay. And self-compassion is, as you guys know from listening, really key. In my analogy that I like, the weed and the root, right? The weed is what you see, and it's grown by a root. So if the weed is turning to sugar or binging or what have you, it's not the problem. The problem is actually that root, and that root is often an inability to self-soothe, an inability to relate to yourself in a compassionate way, because thoughts lead to feelings, lead to behavior. If your thought is, what's wrong with me? What's wrong with me that I can't stop eating? Then you're going to feel terrible. Then you're going to even eat to just get away from your own mean voice. You know, if you say, oh, what's my problem? Why can't I do this? I shoulda, coulda, woulda. You know that harsh, critical, mean voice. And so self-compassion is absolutely one of the keys to getting rid of those roots, right? Because when you can say to yourself, you know what? I am doing the best I can. I'm going to solve this problem that's in front of me. There's nothing wrong with me as a person. I'm likable and lovable. Then you're going to feel pretty good or okay. And when you feel pretty good or okay, you're a lot less likely to use food for comfort or distraction. And even if you feel bad, when you practice self-compassion, then you can respond to yourself with comfort words instead of comfort food. So your relationship to yourself is so key, as you guys know. So I want to open it up to the phones. If anyone has any questions, any comments, anything they'd like to share, doesn't have to be on this particular article or this subject, just anything that's on your mind regarding issues or problems or questions you have about food, weight, or body image issues, please give me a call, 818-602-4929, 818-602-4929. Okay. So now, let's talk a little bit about how to stop stress eating. If you eat when you're stressed, it's really difficult. Oh, here's a call. Hold on. Hi, caller. This is Dr. Nina. What's your name?
Hey, this is Anne. How are you?
Hi, Anne. How are you? Where are you calling from?
I am calling from New York.
New York. Wow, we had a caller last week from New York, too. So how can I help you today?
Good place. So I'm calling. I'm just listening, hearing you talk about self-compassion and what that entails. And so my question is how to make that a consistent practice. Because I know, like, there are moments where I show these, like, I have these brilliant moments where I can show self-compassion, and then there are other moments where it's really hard for me not to slip back into negative self-talk. So I was just wondering if you had any thoughts about how to make it a really consistent practice.
I do, and before I get into that, do you mind sharing what it sounds like when you are when you're practicing that negative self-talk, and what it sounds like when you're being supportive of yourself? What's the difference? Like, how do you talk to yourself when you're mean?
when it's negative, I have a really hard time pretty much eating any meal. I eat meals really consistently, but it seems like I'm always accompanied by this dinner guest who I can never please, you know? So it doesn't really matter what I'm eating or how hungry I am or what time of day it is or anything like that. This uninvited dinner guest or breakfast guest or lunch guest or snack guest or whatever it is, seems to just kind of tag along and, you know, like, I can't believe you're eating. If you eat, you'll never lose weight. If you never lose weight, people won't like you. And it's just kind of like this unending cycle. And so I try and talk back to it in those moments, but it creates this really heightened level of anxiety around almost every meal, even though, like, I've gotten to the point where I can eat all the time. I think that's one of the hardest things. But in those
Sounds
moments
mean.
Of self-compassion.
What a meanie.
But, I know.
That dinner guest is a bitch.
I've all had right. better dinner guests for sure.
I think so. Okay, so that gives me a very good idea of what that negative self-talk sounds like. So now tell me what the positive self-talk sounds like.
Yeah, so the positive self-talk is just really compassionate, kind of like what you were talking about. Like, you're doing incredible. Think of all of the great things you've done today. I'm really proud of you for, you know, X, Y, Z. You know, I see so much progress in where you've been and where you are, and I'm really proud of you for doing that and for doing what's hard. And, yeah, I think that's what the good stuff sounds like.
Okay, it's really interesting because both your negative voice and your compassionate voice are come from a standpoint of second person. So let's do a little experiment, and I want you to say something that the dinner guest says, and this is an uninvited guest and it needs to leave. You said one of the things is, I can't believe I can't believe you're eating. If you don't lose weight, people won't like you. Can you say that again, but from a stance of, if I can't believe I'm eating. If I don't lose weight, people won't like me. Change it to first person.
Oh, I could say it if you really want me to.
Yeah, say it. Say it. If you're up for it, say it, because I think you're going to feel differently when you say it.
Okay. I can't believe I'm eating that. If I don't lose weight, people won't like me.
Now, what was it like to say that as opposed to, because it seemed like there was a little hesitancy in saying that as opposed to the first time you said it, where you said it with ease, you know, people won't like you. What was the feeling?
It made me cringe. Yeah. I physically cringed to put my hand on my face and just was like, oh no, that's not what I wanted to say to myself.
Right, exactly. So one of the things that you can do is catch those moments when you are speaking meanly to yourself, or however you put it, the dinner guest is speaking, and switch it to I. Do not talk to yourself in the second person at all. In fact, say something from the positive side, but first person. Like you said, think of all the good things you're doing. You're doing incredible. Think of all the good things you're doing. Now say that from an I place. I'm doing incredible. Think of all I'm doing. Think of all the things I'm doing.
Yeah. Okay. Think about all of the great things that I'm doing. I'm incredible.
Tell me what that was like.
Empowering, definitely.
Yeah. So one simple thing that you can do is the way that you exorcise this or banish this dinner, this guest, this intruder, I would put it, actually, this intruder, is is only talk to yourself in first person. Because you won't be able to be mean, you'll cringe. It's just really uncomfortable to say those hateful things to yourself when it's from an I place. And even when you're being supportive, there's something a little distancing about using the you voice, right? When you say, when you said, I am incredible, like I felt that, like I believe that. When you said you are incredible, yeah, okay, I believe that you believed it. But it did have more strength and resonance when you came from an I place.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I love that. So do you have any suggestions on how to make that a common practice? Just because I know changing the way that I'll use first person, I talk to myself, can be pretty difficult.
I think just awareness will help you remember. And if you have to, put something like on your phone, I, not you, or, put an alarm, set an alarm and have it just say, I, not you, until it becomes a practice. You have to just kind of put your mind to it and give yourself reminders, literal reminders. I've had people set up email sequences to themselves. There's some online thing where you can send a letter to your future. You can send an email into the future. So they just email things to themselves, like, and set it up so that they get these emails from themselves saying, I, not you, I can do it. So then in time, it just kind of takes root. But in addition to that, you've got to look at what it is that's keeping you connected to this sort of, or attached, I guess, to this mean way of relating to yourself. It's not enough to just change it through changing the habit of it. You really need to look at, well, why did you develop this way of relating to yourself in the first place? And by the way, is there anything about this, either of these voices, that sounds familiar? Has anyone given you a hard time and made you feel like you're not good enough or something like that in your life? doesn't have
to be. I think not necessarily with like body and weight issues. I think I just grew up always really conscious of that naturally. I did grow up, my parents were very, I'd say demanding. I was their first of several children, and so I've seen them get significantly more relaxed. But when I was growing up, it was, well, why did you get an A-? You know, very, very results-oriented, and all from a loving place. They wanted me to do my best. But I think that really kind of shaped this demand for perfectionism, which can show in my tendency to want to eat perfect or exercise perfect or just be perfect.
Which is unattainable. So, and I'm sorry to tell you, there is no perfect. There's only perfectly imperfect. But
right.
So even though, and you know, my stance on parents is parents do their best. Parents do their best given their circumstances, but sometimes their best ends up, for whatever reason, hurting their kids in some way. It doesn't mean, it's not about blaming, it's about explaining that if you get the message of, okay, why'd you get an A-, there's this sense of, well, the A, forget that it's an A-, there's this idea of, like, well, you know, an A or an A+ is the only thing that's okay, and if you fail to reach that penultimate goal, there's something wrong with you. So look, so that's the root, right? So when you are able to really challenge that idea of you only being lovable when you're perfect or when you're achieving some high level of achievement, whatever, in whatever regard, then it's going to be easier for you to remember to be nicer to yourself. And it'll come more naturally.
Well, that sounds like incredible things to work on.
Well, I know you can do it. You sound very reflective, and feel free to, you know, call me back and let me know how you're doing. I'm happy to help.
Yeah, I definitely will. Thank you so much, Nina.
You're welcome, Anne. Bye-bye.
Okay, bye.
Oh, that mean internal voice gets us every time, right? Mean internal voice. Like I was saying, when you're mean to yourself, you feel bad. When you tell yourself you're not going to be, no one's going to love you, ouch. And then you could see how that is a setup for eating to just get away from that mean voice. So hopefully Anne will make use of that and let us know how she does. Okay, so what I was saying is there are two ways. Oh, and let me give the number once again if anyone else would like to call in. 818-602-4929. 818-602-4929. I would love to hear from you about anything that's on your mind in food, weight, or body image issue world. Okay, so keep in mind that when it comes to feelings, there are two ways to deal with feelings. One is to distract yourself from the feelings, and the other is to express them, to actually feel them. So distractions are actions that take you away from yourself, that take you away from whatever it is that's bothering you. So eating is a negative distraction because, as you guys know, it causes you more harm than good. And in fact, people often tell me, you know, in terms of this getting away from yourself, they often say that when they binge or overeat, and I remember this when I was full on into my eating disorder, they feel as if they're in a zone. You know, they're just like in some other space, or they feel like they go numb, right? Eating can take you away from yourself. So eating keeps those uncomfortable feelings away for the moment, but eventually you just end up feeling worse. You know, you temporarily distract yourself from the stressful situation, but you end up beating yourself up for eating and then feeling bad about yourself because you ate, plus you still have the stressful situation. So when you feel bad about what you eat, you feel guilty. When you feel bad about your lack of control, you feel a sense of shame. And that's how eating as a distraction makes you feel worse instead of better. So other distractions, like the woman in the article, she said she takes walks or, you know, things like that. But ultimately, those are just temporary distractions. You can't distract yourself from emotions for good. You can't eat them away. You can't think them away, walk them away. You can't push them away, work them away, starve or deny them. The only way to get rid of feelings is, as counterintuitive as it may sound, the only way to get rid of feelings is to actually feel them. And that is where expressing your feelings comes in. You know, yesterday I was on Dr. Drew's podcast, which was a lot of fun. He's so great. And I was telling this story. We're talking about expressing feelings. And I told the story of my daughter, which when she was little, my youngest daughter fell down in the playground and skinned her knee. And she came up to me and she's like, "Oh, look." And I did everything totally wrong. Like, I absolutely tried to distract her and minimize and do all the things that I tell people not to do. I did them myself. I know how hard it is. So I'm looking at her. I'm like, "Oh, it's okay. It's not that bad." And she keeps crying. "Oh, it hurts. It hurts. It hurts." So I'm like, "Oh, no, it's all right. We'll just put a Band-Aid on it. It's okay. It's going to be fine." She cries harder and harder. And finally, I realize, oh, I'm doing that thing where I am dismissing her feelings. I need to do what I tell people to do and what I know I should do. And I acknowledged it. And I said, "Oh, that really looks painful. Yes, that is a lot of blood." And she sort of went, like she stopped crying and she just sort of started sniffling. And I said, "Yeah, ow, that looks painful." She's like, "Yeah, it hurts." She expressed it. When I stopped denying it by minimizing it and named it, she was able to feel better. So if we just take that example, that's about physical pain. But the same thing is true of emotional pain. You know, if you say to yourself, "Oh, I'm okay. Things could be worse. At least I'm alive." Or all the things that we say to ourselves to make ourselves feel better that are actually very dismissive, then it's not going to change how you feel. But if you have emotional pain, and you're like, yes, validate, acknowledge, and then reassure yourself. When you say, "Yes, it hurts. This really hurts. And of course it hurts." Or it's scary, or whatever it is that you're feeling. If you acknowledge it and validate it and feel it, guess what? It goes away. It goes away. Reminds me of similarly. I was last Christmas or something, I was at the Lego store, and there was this little boy, and he was like begging his mother for one of those ginormous Star Wars sets. And he's like, "Please, Mom, can I have it? Oh, please, please, come on, Mom, please, please, please." And his mother said she would consider getting it for his next birthday. And he looked really disappointed. And he's like, "Oh, it's not fair. I want it now." And she's like, "I know you want it now. I know it's really hard to wait." And he's like, "You never let me have anything. You're so mean." And he started to cry. I don't know. He was 6 or 7. I'm not sure. And his mom was like patting his shoulder. And she's like, "I understand you're upset. It's definitely hard to wait." And he just started, I'm gonna finish that story later. "Hi, Nick." "Hi, Nick. This is Dr. Nina."
"Hi.
I recognized your phone number." "No, I'm psychic." "Oh. No, I'm not psychic. I just recognized your phone number."
"I feel really bad about this because I'm calling you and we're going to talk. I watched a program last night that's really good. This is Life. It was a really big program last year and this year. And they have a young lady with a daughter who is really obese.
This is us?
Is that what it is?
This is us, okay. Yeah.
So, and there's another commercial where a Hawaiian guy for furniture, who is also obese, but they have him dancing with it. I don't know if you've ever seen the commercial, but it's obvious that it's, I get angry that they're on there. I don't want to look at it. I make fun of it. I hate that I do it. I don't want to do it. I've gone with working for my problems with weight, so I know how I look at how I should look at myself and feel good about myself and so on. But I see it. I think, what's wrong with me? Why would I have this terrible feeling about these people that are overweight? I mean, obese, overweight. I mean, it's a big problem. I get very angry when I see it.
You know what I really appreciate about your calls is your honesty. You say the truth that I think a lot of people can relate to, but whatever their weight, but they don't say it. And you call in and you say it. So let's explore this a little. So what you're saying is that when you see people who are extremely overweight on TV or, as you say, in this commercial, that you feel a sense of it, it almost sounds like you get angry. It almost sounds like you feel disgusted.
Right.
Would that be too harsh of a... I don't want to put words in
your
mouth.
No, that's what I really do. So, and I feel badly because of it.
Okay, but let's... You know what? I like to tell people to be curious, not critical. So I understand you feel guilty or you feel bad or you... Like, I hate that you have this reaction, but you're having this reaction. So let's understand why. And I wonder if you have called this show enough to make me understand that perhaps you have such a horror of the idea of yourself gaining weight. You've talked about how you were, as you put it, a fat kid, I believe you said.
Right.
And so it could be that when you see these people on TV, that the disdain and disgust that you had for yourself when you were overweight gets transferred to them. So it's not even about them. It sure seems like it is, but it's about your hatred or your loathing for that part of yourself. What do you think?
That definitely makes sense. I'm obviously feeling what I would feel. And if it got, that would be me, I would be upset.
Yeah.
I would be outraged.
Oh, I just want to say there's someone calling in. If I can ask you to call in after I talk with Nick, I unfortunately do not have the ability to put people on hold. So caller who's calling in, hold that thought. I'll get to you after this call. So I think that what is important is that you get in touch with why you thought you were so unlikable when you were overweight. I think, didn't you say you went to your high school, like your 50th high school reunion? And
yeah, I did.
And you were so surprised that people liked you, that's when you were fat, and that they still... That they liked you, which was so in contrast with your view of yourself.
Right. And yeah, it was absolutely wonderful. And I mean, it said something like I lost a lot of weight. And
But they still liked
you.
I mean,
it felt great.
Yeah, they liked you before.
They liked me then, too.
Yeah. So there's something about about weight and being heavy that you associate with being unlikable, unlovable, and with yourself, and then you can't bear it in yourself, and then you see these people on TV, you see a guy who's overweight dancing around in a Hawaiian shirt, and he's just happy and fine, and you see this woman on TV, and you know she's trying to come to terms with her body, and they're not filled with self-loathing, but your self-loathing for your the fat you gets transferred to them. And when you understand that, maybe you won't be so hard on yourself. But what needs to happen is for you to get more comfortable with the you that was overweight as a kid.
All right, come on, how are we going to get rid of that?
Keep calling, Nick. By realizing that the ideas that you had about yourself were just ideas. The ideas that you had that there was something wrong with you and that that unlovable you was bound up in weight, and that by losing weight, you lost the unlovable part of you. These are just ideas. They're interpretations, and they have nothing to do with reality. People like you because of you. Fat or thin?
Okay. Yeah. I'll keep you posted on this one.
But just when you have some understanding, and I think it took a lot of courage to call and say, hey, I'm having this reaction. It's not, you know, PC or whatever. But It really isn't even about what you think it is about. It's about your own, you know, it's about yourself. And when you love yourself, you're not going to hate on those people.
Yeah, because I like I said, you got another caller, but, you know, I feel really guilty disliking these people. You know, it's everything against what we've been working on.
But it's the guilt, it's not them. It appears to be them that you dislike, but maybe it's their ease and comfort in their own with their weight, or maybe it's your disdain and hatred of your own weight that you're finding in them. So instead of, you can't hate yourself because you've lost weight, so you hate the fat you in them, if that makes any sense. And when you realize that, then it's like, okay, it's not that you're being a bad guy, and it's that you have something unresolved to work through about yourself.
Thank you, Dr. Nina.
You are so welcome, Nick. I hope I didn't freak you out too much by answering with your name. I remembered
your phone.
Your phone number.
That's all right, come on. Maybe you'll have the guy from Burbank on the phone.
Yeah, Larry from Burbank. I haven't heard from him for a couple of weeks.
Thank you so much.
You're welcome. I'll talk to you next week. Be nice to yourself. Stay curious, not critical.
Okay.
Bye. Remember, if you are doing something or thinking something, doing something you want to do, not doing something you want to do, thinking something you don't want to think, there's always a reason for it. And when you really understand that reason and process it and work through it and get to it, that's everything changes. And here's my caller coming back. Hi, caller. Thanks for calling back. This is Dr. Nina.
Hi, this is Jessica. I called last week about my friend.
Yes.
I don't know if you remember me.
Jessica from New York. Yes.
Yes, yeah.
Yes. I remember
yeah,
you.
Exactly. So I was basically just calling back because I took your advice, and I think, like, in the way that, because last week I was basically talking to you about how I didn't know how to bring it up with her. That I felt that she was hiding an eating disorder.
Yes, I remember.
And that I was worried about her. And so I did bring it up with her, like, in all the ways that you said, like, just to be super comforting. And she definitely got defensive at first. Like, she kept just trying to tell me that she was sick. And I basically just said, like, I understand that, like, you know, what if that's what you want to say to me, like, I'm here for you no matter what. But just know that if it is something more than that, that I'm also here. And the only reason I'm bringing it up is not to judge you, but because I'm worried about you. And I think that at this point, she's not fully ready to tell me still. And I know that you gave me like those links about like how to help her and stuff. Yeah. And I think that at this point in time, she wasn't ready for me. Like, I didn't want to bombard her with like the first time I bring it up with her to then be like, and here are a bunch of links to help you. because of the fact that she got defensive at first. So, I just kind of said that I was here and that I just basically wanted to call back and say thank you and that I did make the first step in talking to her. And I think that by the end of our conversation, I could tell that she kind of wanted to tell me, but that she just wasn't ready yet.
Well,
so,
Jessica, you're like the poster child for the best friend ever. I mean,
you
showed
thank
a tremendous amount of sensitivity and understanding. And I have to say, you know, it's funny. I am someone who cannot keep a plant alive. Like, I cannot, but I have all of these analogies to, you know, weed in the root. And I'm about to give you another one, which is you basically planted a seed. You planted a seed, and the more that you kind of water that seed by circling back and just being there and being a safe person and bringing it up and not letting her like dodge it completely, but not being, it sounds like you did a nice job of being right in the middle of kind of letting her know that you're on to her without shaming her. And the more that you do that, the easier it'll get for her to perhaps, you know, and hopefully open up to you. Bloom!
Yeah, because the first time I ever brought it up with her, like, I remember telling you that she just automatically was like, what are you talking about? Like, I have had the flu. And I kind of wanted to be like, you've had the flu for a really long time, and it happens to, like, you don't seem to have the flu when you're hungry to eat, but then you suddenly have the flu after you eat. And I think the first time I brought it up with her, like, before I called your show, she was just very much like adamant about, no, you're crazy, I just have the flu. But this time, I think the way that you talked to me about how to handle it definitely made at least a small impact on her, and I could tell that she was starting to ease up. So I hope that she decides to come to me with it, but I also don't want to like be pressuring her more and more and more so that she feels self-conscious about coming to me, you know?
And the more that you talk about what she's feeling versus what she's doing, it'll be easier.
Maybe that's a good... Yeah, because every time I do bring it up, it is about like the action of what I hear her doing. So maybe next time I should just talk to her about what she's going through right now in her life.
Exactly, because that's why she's doing whatever she's doing. I mean, if this purging behavior is because of something emotional. And so the more that she can have a language for talking about it, the less she's going to enact it. And the more she can trust that other people, you are there to support her, and that you normalize perhaps difficult feelings or, you know, something like that, then the more she opens up and the more she lets the words out and can lean on you, and I'm sure, you know, you reciprocate and you have this mutuality, hopefully, the less the behavior is going to happen.
Yeah, because more than anything, like, I just want her to feel like she has somebody to confide in about that, because I know other people that have gone through eating disorders, and it's such a, it's like, I feel like it almost becomes, I don't know if that's the right word, but I feel like it almost becomes an addiction of sorts, like her throwing up, like she gets like I'm not talking about her specifically, but just other people that I've known, like that have talked to me about it. It's like it becomes an addiction where even when they realize why they're doing it, it's like they feel like they can't stop it anymore because they become so used to doing that. It's like such an outlet for them.
That's just
their first go-to, even if they're aware like this is not how I should be dealing with it. They still just do it because they're kind of addicted to the feeling of getting getting it out in that manner.
Or that it works. And insight, that's why insight, you actually make a good point, Jessica, which is that knowing something does not lead to change. Insight does not lead to change. If just because you know something does not mean that there is no Oprah aha moment that leads to change. An Oprah aha moment like, oh my God, does not make you change your behavior. It just makes you realize why you're doing what you're doing. And then you got to do the tough work of understanding, you know, why you came to relate to yourself this way and deal with unpleasant thoughts and feelings so that you can do, so that you can liberate yourself actually from it. But it's tough.
Right. So when I do, like, just down the line, because I do have a feeling that this is going to take a while. I mean, I did, after you talking to me, it really did help me in the way that I was able to approach her. But I do have a feeling, just based on her reaction, that it's going to take more than one discussion. But I'm just curious, like, down the line, when she does start to talk to me about what she's doing, how do I get her to realize, like, how do I get her to stop? You know what I mean? Like, well, like what you just said, like knowing something and feeling something are different. So even if she knows what she's doing is wrong, like if she does feel that it's kind of like out of her, because a lot of times in my experience with people, they feel like it's almost out of their control. Like they feel like now all of a sudden they've become so used to purging their feelings literally and the food physically that they think that's how they just deal with it automatically, and even if they don't want to, they just do that. So how can I get her to stop doing that?
Well, you can't get her to stop. Only she can get to the place of choosing to stop. But you can help her get some resources that will help her. She cannot deal with it alone. And it's something that's outside your ability as a friend. So getting her some kind of help, some kind of professional help, there, you know, even a free group out there is better than nothing. Getting her to someone who can help her, because she needs sort of professional help rather than friend help, you know.
Right.
And take the burden off yourself for making her change. You just have to.
Right.
You have to lead her to water and hope that she drinks, not that she's a horse. You have to open the door and hope that and she can come through. Right. You can just bring her. You can just open the door, but she's got to take herself through that door.
Right. And what is your best advice? I mean, I'm just asking for people that do feel like it becomes almost like an addiction, like not even about my friend anymore, but what is your best advice when they feel like addicted to that feeling of release?
I like to say it's not a food addiction. If we use the word addiction, it's an eating addiction. It's using eating to resolve something psychological. It's using whatever it is, work, sex, gambling, alcohol, whatever it is that people use to distract from themselves, what they have to do is figure out what it is that they cannot be with. First, what it is you cannot be with, that you've got to use the behavior to distract from, and process that, because the behavior, the bad behavior that hurts you, is a solution to the problem. It is not the problem. The problem needs to be identified and worked through. And that's the hard part.
Right.
But that's what I'm here to help people do.
Yeah. No, exactly. And that's what I'm asking, because obviously when I first called, like, about my friend, like, that was my primary concern. But I also, like, myself, I've struggled with ways of coping. But with me, I feel like it's really weird because, like you said, like, knowing and feeling things are completely different. So, like, I'll be very aware. Like, I've caught myself, doing things that I, in a way, like, to avoid my feelings that I know in my head are not healthy. And I am also, like, always aware of why I'm doing it. But I feel like sometimes I get to a place where, like, I can't stop myself from doing that.
Well, I think it takes a lot of courage to call in and share that. And will you do me a favor and call me back next week? We're unfortunately just about out of time, but I really want to talk to you about this because I think a lot of people can relate to what you're saying, and I want to help.
All right. I will.
Okay.
Thank you, Dr. Nina, and thank you for talking to me about my friend. I think that I'm at least on the road to recovery with her. I just suddenly decided to bring up myself.
I'm but, really glad you did, Jessica. Call me back next week and let's continue this conversation.
I will.
Okay.
I will. All right. Thank you, Dr. Nina.
Take
as always.
Good care.
Thank
You're
you.
Welcome. Bye. And that is our show for today. Thank you all so much for joining me today. I had a call that I think was Larry from Burbank, but I did not. I wasn't able to get Larry from Burbank. If that was you, please call in next week and let us know how you're doing. I'm here every Wednesday at 10 a.m. Pacific here on LA Talk Radio to give you the skinny on weight loss without dieting and create a healthier, happier relationship to food. Visit me at winthedietwar.com or find out about my program, my online program at kickthedietwar.com, and I'd love to hear from you, so send me a message on Facebook or Twitter or email with any questions you'd like me to cover on the show, or call in next week. I'll see you then. Bye-bye.
You're listening to The Dr. Nina Show with Dr. Nina Savelle-Rocklin, only on LA Talk Radio.